Marty Moscowane, welcome to Radio Times. David K. Randall has been a lousy sleeper for most of his life. He used to fall asleep with his eyes open when he was a little kid. Later in college, he was known for yelling things in his sleep, much to his roommate's amusement. His wife wears earplugs because he grunts and sings and laughs and giggles in his sleep. But it was a sleepwalking incident that became a kind of wake-up call. Randall decided to find out more about sleep and interviewed a number of researchers for his new book called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. While some can doze off as soon as their head hits the pillow, for others, nighttime is a battle to get and stay asleep. David Randall is a senior reporter at Reuters. He's also an adjunct professor of journalism at New York University, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And David Randall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I'm sure you get asked this all the time. How did you sleep last night?
I slept pretty well, surprisingly, considering I have a 2-month-old baby. once he comes in the room, you know, everything's up to, you never know what's going to happen.
Indeed. Well, tell us a little about this sleepwalking incident. And there have been several where you have literally walked into a wall in your apartment.
The biggest one, the reason I kind of started looking into this book and sleep in general, was went to bed one night a couple summers ago. Everything seemed normal. Then about 2 in the morning, I wake up. I'm on my back in the hallway, got a searing pain in my knee, quickly figure out, hey, I've been sleepwalking, and I sleepwalked into that wall, and that really hurts. So I went to the doctor and spent a night in the sleep lab, did all that, and I came back, and he said, you know, I have to be honest with you. We know a lot about sleep, but there's a lot that we don't know. So the best advice I can give you is take it easy. And that was the
he
first
said, thanks a lot.
Yeah,
right?
That was the first time I ever heard a doctor basically say, take it easy. You know, it was almost like I sleepwalked past the frontier. You know, the medical community could no longer help me. So I decided to find out, you know, why don't we know more about sleep? And if sleep is affecting me like this, you know, I'm walking into walls, it's got to be affecting other people too. So I wanted to find out all the ways sleep impacts what we do, how we raise our kids, how we live our life.
Did they have a diagnosis for you?
They said I had periodic limb movements disorder, which is, you know, on the totem pole of scary sleep disorders. It's on the very bottom, which basically means I kick.
And your wife can probably attest.
Yes, she can definitely attest. She moves all the way over the other side of the bed. It's almost like get out of the splash zone, if you will. They said, you know, we could give you sedatives at night, but we don't want you to take drugs that you don't need. And I agree with that. Mm-hmm. So I've, you know, basically just tried to do other things.
And have you had other incidents where you have walked in your sleep and hurt yourself?
Well, sleepwalking, researchers found, is drawn out by stress. There can be two components. There can be stress and a genetic component. Oddly enough, I learned I had the genetic component after I started working on this. My dad was telling me, oh, you know, I was a sleepwalker too. And he grew up on a farm in Kansas. And he would tell me stories of, oh, yeah, I woke up in the cornfields a couple times. And to me, that sounded more like an alien abduction than maybe sleepwalking. But, you know, stress, too. Since the baby, I've been sleepwalking a little bit more.
Oh,
you know, sleep deprivation can do it. You know, not long ago, I woke up in front of the bassinet. My wife woke up and saw me swing my arms back and forth in front of the bassinet saying, I've got the baby, I've got the baby.
And you were asleep?
I was asleep. And thank God the baby was asleep in the bassinet. It had no idea the crazy things his father was doing.
So the fact that you, as a little kid, would sleep or at least fall asleep with your eyes open, yelling and screaming, making noises in your sleep, that all is part of a pattern of some sleep problems, at least, that you have?
Yes, and that typically that happens for other people, too. Someone who might sleepwalk, as an adult, they might sleepwalk as a child, too. Sleepwalking for kids is actually very common. Something like 1 in 5 teenagers and below will sleepwalk at least once in their lives. As you get older, the amount of sleepwalking declines. Scientists still don't know why, however. And also the nature of it changes. Mm-hmm. When a kid sleepwalks, you know, generally they might walk into the hallway and it's easy to put them back down. And when adults sleepwalks, if you try to wake them up, they might act out violently. And again, researchers don't know why.
Well, you write about, or researchers told you about parasomnias. So these are things besides sleepwalking that people have done in their sleep.
Exactly. It's almost as if any behavior you can think of that you can do in your waking life, you can do it in your sleep too. There have been many cases of sleep driving, sleep eating, someone having sex in their sleep, all these things, and then they wake up the next day and have no conscious memory of it. It's almost as if somebody else took control of their body and they're waking up and dealing with all the effects.
And were they on sleeping pills or some kind of medication that might explain this behavior?
It can happen both naturally and it can happen because of sleeping pills. Popular ones like Ambien, they now come with prescription on the labels. There's warnings that, you know, they've been found to have a higher rate of sleep driving, sleep eating. It's very common to hear people tell stories of, you know, I took an Ambien, then I went out, I went, fell asleep. The next morning, I went to my kitchen and I saw half-eaten food everywhere. Or somebody else was telling me a story of, you know, he took an Ambien, he went to bed. The next day, his son said, "Hey, Dad, you were acting strange last night." And he was saying, "You know, what are you talking about? I don't remember that whatsoever." And his son basically said that the dad walked into the living room, started eating peanut butter with his hands, and then started praying in front of the TV. And he had no memory of that whatsoever.
Do we know why, or do researchers know why we sleep? I mean, I guess we should sleep about a third of our life. I don't think many of us do that, but nonetheless, why do we sleep?
That's a big question, surprisingly. Researchers know that basically we need 1 hour of sleep for every 2 hours that we're awake. Why we need to sleep, they're still not sure. We can see all the outcomes of it. We can see what happens if you don't sleep. You know, if you sleep continuously less than 6 hours or so a night, you are basically going to act, you're going to act like you're drunk. You're going to have less ability to solve problems. You're going to have less spatial awareness. You're going to be more impulsive. And then if you do that for a long time, your body's going to start feeling the effects of that trauma. You know, there's going to be high rates of obesity, of diabetes. It can lead to heart attack, stroke, every other kind of this rogues gallery of health disorders. But that doesn't solve the question of why we and every other animal needs to sleep. One of the most famous studies, they sequestered rats and they thought, let's see what happens if a rat goes longer and longer without sleep. So a rat went 2 weeks continuously awake, and then, you know, these rats died. And in pretty gruesome ways, you know, their fur started falling out. They would have sores that wouldn't heal. And scientists, you know, performed autopsies to find out what exactly is it. And they didn't know. The best guess was, you know, going longer and longer without sleep makes you lose the ability to regulate your temperature. But humans, we still don't know.
Well, but what's interesting, and based on some of the research that you have done, is that many people do get less than 6 hours of sleep a night. And the question being, are they risking their health, either mental or physical, because of that lack of sleep?
Exactly. It's about one out of about every three working Americans, about 41 million Americans, gets less than 6 hours of sleep a night continuously. And there are health effects left and right from this. Not only are you danger to yourself, you know, heart attack, all those kind of things, you're danger to other people. About one out of every five car accidents are caused by a drowsy driver.
And are people not getting that requisite amount of sleep because they're watching TV, they're on their computer, they're staring at their cell phone?
There's so many reasons. All of the above, actually. There's part of the cultural reason. You know, it's so easy for us to think, you know, I have so many things to do. You know, I can dose myself with coffee. I can put off sleep. I'm so strong, I don't need it. And, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead. When you look at the research, if you're saying I'm going to sleep until you're dead, you're not really living either.
No.
But then the other part of it is that so many of us sleep so differently than how our bodies are built to sleep. It's only been about 100 years ago that we've had so much electric lights because of the light bulb. Before then, we would sleep in two different shifts, and this was completely normal. You would fall asleep around 10 o'clock each night. You'd stay that way until about 1 or 2 o'clock. You'd wake up for an hour. You expected to wake up for this hour, and you'd spend that time in between just kind of relaxing. You might think about your dreams. You might read. You might talk to your loved one. You might have sex, you know, what have you. Then you would go back to sleep, and it was called the first sleep and the second sleep. The interesting thing with this was that researchers in the late 80s decided, let's see what happens, all the effects of all this electric light. So they sequestered people to see what would happen. For the first week or so, they slept as much as they wanted. They were like kids in a candy store.
And did they sleep a lot?
They slept, you know, 14 hours a night. Then after they kind of caught up on all that missed sleep that they didn't have, they started exhibiting the same pattern of this first sleep and a second sleep. It was as if their bodies were exercising a muscle that they never knew they had.
Well, in fact, you quote one of the authors of the study saying that time that they were awake was a period of meditation, that they felt very relaxed in that hour or so that they might be awake. And they would naturally wake up at that time?
Exactly. And they would wake up around the same time every night. And it wasn't just a feeling of, you know, they were half awake, so that's why they felt nice. They actually drew subjects' blood to find out what was going on. And they realized that they had a higher level of the hormone prolactin, which is the same hormone that chickens have in their bloodstreams when they're sitting on their eggs, and it's contented haze. So it really was a time when you felt relaxed naturally. And now what happens is that so many people might wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they think, something's wrong with me. Right. I'm supposed to fall asleep at 10 o'clock. I'm supposed to stay that way until whenever I want to wake up. So if I'm waking up, I need to make a change, and maybe I need to take a sleeping pill or something else. And they end up medicating a condition that's just kind of standard on the human body that we just don't know about, and many sleep researchers don't know about, too.
But can we say that before the light bulb was invented, before we had so much artificial light, that this was probably how humans slept?
Yes, we can definitely say that. It's really changed with the light bulb and the popularity of coffee. When you know anthropologists contacted the Tiv culture in central Nigeria in the 1960s, and they were still sleeping this segmented sleep, and they basically had the same terms of first sleep and second sleep.
And is it because our brain is so wired that there's something about the light so that the brain convinces us that it's actually daylight, which makes it hard for us to go to sleep?
That's a big part of it. We have so many bright lights now, and you know our bodies are built for a time when the sun was pretty much running the show. Mm-hmm. There was no bright light at night. So when we look at our TV monitors or our computer monitors or our iPhones or iPads especially, that bluish white light, our brains interpret that as sunlight. So there's this idea that I need to stay up longer. And if you're reading your iPad at night in your bed and then you turn it off and think you can just turn your head over and fall asleep instantly, that's asking your brain to do something that's completely unnatural.
We're almost having our first break here, but what do you do now that you know this? Do you kind of unplug before you go to sleep?
Yes, it's, you know, for researchers say too, you know, for about an hour before you go to bed, start watching your exposure to bright lights. Start, you know, turning things down. Start turning the TV off. Just make it easier for your body and brain to make that transition to sleep, as opposed to saying, hey, this is an on-off switch, and I can just flip it and go to sleep instantly. It's just not that simple.
And has it been helpful for you?
Definitely. I mean, when you have a two-month-old baby, it changes a little bit. But until then, we were doing pretty well.
Well, let's talk about that two-month-old baby after this very short break, talking with David K. Randall about his new book. It's called Dreamland, and it's subtitled Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. He's a senior reporter for Reuters, also an adjunct professor of journalism at New York University. And his book began with his own sleepwalking, and it led him to interesting research that's been done on a whole host of issues related to sleep. He's not a clinician. He is a journalist. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne. When MTV News producer Ben Wagner turned 30, he went to Nantucket and met someone very special.
I was standing watching the sunset, and from the edge of the dune heard, "Is the birthday boy here?" And turned, and there he is.
It was Mr. Rogers. What did he talk about with the world's kindest man? Find out on Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Vice President Joe Biden says he was making a point about Mitt Romney's economic policies when he said this to a largely black audience.
He's going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. They're going to put you all back in chains.
Was the comment out of bounds or just tough talk for a tough campaign? The Barbershop Guys weigh in next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So how did you sleep last night? We're talking about sleep with David K. Randall, author of a new book called Dreamland. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Before we talk about your two-month-old baby, let me get Righteous from New Hope to join us. And Righteous, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Talking to a friend about the 24-hour sleep cycle that they say we generally subscribe to, but he was mentioning to me, and he happened to be a scientist, that there's new research about a 26-hour, an extra 2 hours that a lot of human beings might find easier, you know, to about a 26-hour cycle that we might, you know.
Sure.
I just wanted to know if the journalist had any information on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Righteous, thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Randall.
Sure. David. So basically what you're talking about is we all have a circadian rhythm, which basically is a 24-hour clock that guides when we should wake up, when we should fall asleep, and this can change over time. You know, when you're a teenager, I'm sure many of us can remember it feeling impossible to wake up before 6 or 7 a.m. for that first bell, and then feeling like it was impossible to fall asleep before 10 or 11 at night. That's because of our circadian rhythm. That changes throughout your life.
Driven in part by hormones, I guess, for teenagers.
Exactly. By hormones, there's the whole host of theories why, you know, as you get older, too, when you're over 55, 60, this changes, too. You might fall asleep early in the night, you know, 8 or 9, then wake up at 2 or 3 and find it impossible to go back to sleep. But there are cases where people, their 24-hour cycle is a little bit off. It might be a 22-hour cycle. Mm-hmm. It might be a 26-hour cycle. And then they find it hard to get into this rhythm. Sleep researchers have seen a lot of these cases. And to treat them, if somebody wants to stay on a 24-hour cycle, they do different things. They change their exposure to light. This kind of brings it back into what we were saying before. The circadian rhythm really is based on the length of a day and how much light you see. So that's why, you know, say you fly to Paris. The reason the jet lag is so hard is that, you know, say you fly there overnight, you wake up or you get there at 6 or 7 in the morning, you know, it's 7, 8 Paris time, maybe it's 2 o'clock your time, your brain sees that sunlight and thinks, it's not the next day, it's still the day before, so I should stay up even longer. So that way you get so off of the sun cycle. And this could only happen in the last 70 years or so, and that's why they call it jet lag.
Hmm.
And this affects sports, too.
Sure.
There have been research studies that found that on Monday Night Football, it always starts at the exact same time. It always starts at 8:30 at night. When the West Coast team is playing an East Coast team, the West Coast team has a slight advantage.
Advantage
that the players don't really know about, because as you go into the third and fourth quarter, the East Coast team, their bodies are naturally getting prepared for sleep. You know, their reaction times are slowing, their temperature is dropping, all these things that they can't control. It's not just they can have coffee and they'd be fine. And, you know, in sports, especially the NFL, it's a game where the teams are so evenly matched. And if one person messes up and slightly slower, then there can be a real effect. And they found that they looked at Las Vegas odds for these last 25 years, and the West Coast team beat the point spread something like 70% of the time. And if you're betting on sports, this is almost like found money.
Interesting. Well, speaking of sports, I do want to get to your baby. But speaking of sports, you also write about a coach, I guess, for a pitcher for the Texas Rangers, thinking about sleep and how using sleep could help improve a pitcher's performance.
Exactly. There's been research that has found that naps and sleep, especially, but naps and too, really help you prepare. And for pitchers, this is especially important, because it's not just an athletic competition. You know, if you look at pitchers, their body types are completely different. One might be, you know, 180 pounds and really lean, and one might be 300 pounds.
And almost chubby.
And it's not necessarily, their job isn't to run faster, it's to throw a baseball that somebody else can't hit. So half of their job is a mental part. So his idea was that he was going to have his pitchers get to the stadium before everybody else and make them take a nap before they pitched. you know, and it was controlled nap, you know, made sure he was, they were sleeping in the right conditions. And the idea was that they were going to have this mental edge. They're not forfeiting all those ideas with, you know, I should know that this pitcher, this batter tends to swing at a curveball, or I can get him out this way. And the idea was that if they are, his pitchers were at the best of their abilities for the most amount of times over this such a long 162 game season, that advantage would just increase exponentially as the season went on.
Did it?
Yes, his players. They saw how well the pitchers were doing, and just they felt rested. Baseball is a brutal, brutal schedule. You can go from playing in Oakland to Philadelphia to back to Oakland within 1 week. You know, you're crisscrossing the country for two straight weeks at a time often. You're playing at 1 p.m., then you're playing at 7 p.m., and then you have a doubleheader. So it's a brutal sport on the body. And his other players who weren't pitchers started seeing, hey, these guys are feeling good, and I'm not. What are they doing? You know, baseball, like every other sport, once somebody's doing well, other people want to copy it.
So they started taking naps?
Yeah, they would start taking naps. They started going to sleep at certain times. You know, he would pass out things to all their players on the bus saying, this is when you should wake up. This is how bright you should have your room. This is what temperature the hotel room should be at.
And it worked. Interesting. Well, let's talk about the fact that you're an expert on sleep and you're also a new parent, which means you probably have to cobble together some hours of sleep at night.
Exactly. When you go from having 3 hours a night each of sleep each night to 5 hours when your baby starts sleeping a little bit more, it feels like the most luxurious thing in the world.
So obviously, if you're a caring parent, you're, especially when they're little, you're going to get up with them and feed them and try to get them back to sleep. Is there any research on sort of how to do that better than just the kind of haphazard way that it's often done?
It's so hard over the first couple months, yeah. You know, first 4-6 months to a year. It's so hard to get any child into a kind of sleep rhythm. Mm-hmm. But when you go from there, researchers have found that the best thing you can do is just to stay with a pattern, stay to some kind of rhythm. And this is whether, you know, the idea of Ferberizing your baby, you know, letting him or her sleep, cry it out in their own room if they start crying, or the idea of, you know, attachment parenting, you know, I'm going to be there at every second. Maybe the baby will sleep in the same bed with me. They haven't found if there's a better, one way or the other is better in terms of sleep outcomes. They found what the most important thing is that you just have a rhythm so that
a consistency
so the child knows what's coming. And that's the same thing with us. You know, if we have a hard time sleeping, if we stay to some kind of rhythm, some kind of consistency, research has found that's the best way for our brains to expect to go to sleep, to know what's coming next.
You also have found from some of the research that people actually sleep better when they sleep alone.
Exactly. That was really interesting.
Yes.
This was a study done by a British researcher named Dr. Neil Stanley, and he basically thought, you know, what's the effect of sharing a bed? And he found that those who share a bed wake up about 50% more during the night than those who sleep in separate beds. And, you know, this is far from romantic. Most people share a bed because it feels good. So the idea was, you know, if your brainwaves say you sleep better alone, but then most people sleep together, why? Why does this work? And there's different reasons. You know, perhaps there's an emotional component to it. You know, it feels good to have somebody near you. And then there's also the idea that, you know, our beds are so much wider than they used to be. You know, if you have the California King and all these other beds, you almost are sleeping in separate beds. You can move away far enough away that you're not getting kicked. You're not getting jostled. And then the other idea is that, you know, if you do sleep in separate beds, there's more research that shows that if you have that conversation first about, you know, Yeah, it's not personal. I'm moving to a different bed, not because I don't like you, but because, you know, you have a sleep apnea device, you know, the CPAP. And it sounds like Darth Vader is next to me, and I'm not sleeping now. And another component of this, too, is that, you know, men tend to snore more often than women, and women tend to be very light sleepers. So it's almost as if women are dealing with the effects of a sleep issue, even though they don't actually have the issue. So the sleep issue becomes an issue. And that's one reason why separate beds happen.
Do you sleep in separate beds, or do you have a gigantic bed so that you're not kicking your wife?
We have as a gigantic bed as you can in a small Brooklyn apartment.
I know exactly what that apartment looks like. David K. Randall, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about sleep, what we know, what we don't know about sleep. And his new book is called Dreamland: Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I was thinking about the fact that, you know, we don't generally sleep on straw, you know, pallets on the floor. For the most part, people have a, you know, pretty good mattress, maybe a pretty good pillow. There's so many things that we have created for ourselves to help us sleep, and yet we don't seem to have, generally speaking, the kind of benefits of that kind of furniture or material.
One of the most interesting studies I came across was, so there were researchers at a hospital in Germany, and they thought, you know, we have people in here all the time. We want them to be comfortable. What is the best mattress that we can have? You know, what is the one ideal mattress? And they found that there is no ideal mattress. It's basically what you're used to. So if you go into a store and decide, I'm going to buy a new mattress, the one you're going to find the most comfortable most likely is the one that you're already sleeping on right now.
The kind of physical imprint, I guess, which is why if you go to a hotel and it's not your bed, it just doesn't feel quite right.
Exactly.
Even if it's a very nice hotel.
Exactly. You know, it might be softer than you expect, or lumpier, or harder. All these other things that just makes us feel uncomfortable.
Let me get to, it looks like Shamgi from New Hope to join us. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
My name is Shamgi.
Hi, Shamgi. Go ahead.
I am a meditation teacher, and I found that people who go to bed earlier at night and are able to wake up before dawn have less problem with insomnia, and they are able to meditate more naturally because they follow a certain rhythm. It's called the rhythm of the chakras. I don't know if your audience is familiar with the subtle body. But I have found that when you synchronize these rhythms, your pineal gland, which is really responsible for your production of serotonin and melatonin, you see, 2 hours before the sunrise, your pineal gland senses the oncoming light, and it starts to reduce the amount of melatonin and starts to increase the serotonin, which is the feel-good hormone that you use for the rest of your life.
Well, that's fascinating.
And then, of course, at night you will feel sleepy just after maybe two hours after the sun goes down, which is our natural rhythm. Well, and it is because the rhythm has been mixed up because of the electric light that we have this problem to begin with.
Well, I appreciate the call, and I think you're underscoring exactly what our guest, David Randall, has been saying. But the idea, perhaps, of going to bed earlier, that's what I hear Shamgi saying.
That's a great point. And it does kind of play into the idea of a circadian rhythm, that we're all kind of a 24-hour or so schedule. And if you do focus on, I'm going to go to bed earlier, then there are going to be generally better outcomes. It's when you decide to say, I'm going to have coffee, I'm going to do all these other things. That's when you have all these other issues. The U.S. military, for instance, they have found that sleeplessness is a leading cause of friendly fire. About 1 in 4 deaths and friendly fire deaths in the first Iraq war were the result of sleeplessness.
Wow.
And the reason is that, you know, sleep, it sounds obvious, but it makes it harder to make good decisions. It makes it harder to have control of your body and your emotions. And it just led to these bad outcomes.
Well, and one of the things that you say, and I had never thought about this, obviously combat fatigue, is there's nothing new about that, but you're saying that because of serving in the military, especially in some of these wars, is more demanding, that combat fatigue is a bigger problem.
Exactly. Say you are on a naval ship. A generation ago, there may be 500 other sailors. Now there's maybe only 200 because of computers. So everything, every decision you make has a bigger impact. There's less, there's fewer other people who are backup. So you have to be at your best at the longest amount of time possible. And this puts a bigger pressure on you. It also happens, you know, during the occupation of Iraq, a researcher at Walter Reed, which is the big military facility down in outside of D.C., he was showing me a graph that showed that those who slept less than 6 hours a night, especially 4 hours, 2 hours, they were the most likely to get into an altercation with a civilian than those who had slept longer, for 8 hours or so. So it seems like, you know, we all need know we need to sleep, but there are real-world effects that can harm, that can literally put us into harm when we're not sleeping.
Let me get, looks like John from Pensauken to join our conversation. And John, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi. And, hi there. I'm glad to see a new books come out on this subject. I have a lot of pain when I try to sleep. I had bad hernia surgery about 9 years ago. Mm. What has your research shown for people that are in pain when they go to sleep that have a hard time finding a comfortable position to get to sleep easier?
And John, has this been for the last 9 years since that surgery?
Yes.
Yeah, so this has been a kind of a chronic problem for you. I'm hoping that you have got some help from a clinician, either your own doctor or a sleep clinician. But let me see what David Randall says. Go ahead, David.
That's obviously got to be a hard situation. And, you know, the best advice always is to go to your doctor first, and he or she will do the best thing for you. But then there are other things that sleep research suggests that helps you fall asleep naturally. I don't know if it's going to be applicable in your situation or not, but certain things like taking a hot shower before you go to bed, or conversely, taking a cold shower. The idea is that what brings on sleep onset is our body temperature dropping. So say you sit in a sauna for half an hour, not long before you go to bed, as your body temperature drops, you're naturally going to want to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. So that makes it easier. So perhaps that'll help deal with the pain, too. Other things, you know, like we were saying, watching your exposure to light, watching your exposure to just kind of stimulating things. It's probably not a great idea to watch Breaking Bad right before you go to bed.
Guilty as charged. Yes, go
it'll,
ahead.
It'll get you aroused. It'll be a bigger tax on your mind. So the insomnia is really a battle on two parts. It's the physical part of getting comfortable, and then the mental part of letting your brain basically kind of forget about everything and forget about focusing on itself. There was a philosopher in the 60s who had a famous quote who basically said that sleep is like a bird on your hand that'll stay there as long as you don't look at it. So you have to let yourself kind of give up. And that's one of the hardest things to do. That's why insomnia is kind of called almost an ironic condition, because you want sleep so badly that you can't get it.
And the idea of sleep is giving up, is letting go. And if you're worried about going back to sleep, that's what you're not doing.
Exactly. So many of us have woken up at 3 in the morning and looked at our clock and thought, you know, I have to wake up at 6. If I fall asleep right now, I can get what I need. And that puts pressure on ourselves. You know, one famous study for insomnia, they separated groups of college students, and they each had a Walkman, and they had a tape that played. One group had, you know, calming, kind of new age music, whale sounds, things like that, and the voice came over and said, fall asleep whenever you want, just take your time. The another group had blaring marching band music, you know, trumpets and everything else. And that wasn't the real issue that made it hard for them to sleep. It was a voice that came on that said, you are going to be tested on how quickly you can fall asleep. And not only did they take longer to fall asleep than the other group, the competitors, they woke up throughout the night more often. So it wasn't just the onset of sleep. That stress stayed with them throughout the night, and they kept on waking up.
And that's David K. Randall. We are talking about sleep today on Radio Times, and his new book is called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. We have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Borgata supports WHYY and presents Katie Lang, Friday, August 24th, and Art Garfunkel, Friday, September 14th. Both shows are at 9 p.m. in the Music Box. Ticket details at theborgata.com.
Good morning, great Satan of America. How are you? I am fine, thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Sacha Baron Cohen talks about his comedy The Dictator, in which he plays the corrupt, tyrannical ruler of a fictional oil-rich nation in northern Africa. It's out on DVD next week. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Is it time for the West to intervene in Syria, and what might that look like? Also, the mighty Mississippi was flooding this time last year. Now people who live and work along it say they are seeing sandbars they haven't seen in years. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with David K. Randall. He's a senior reporter at Reuters, author of a new book called Dreamland, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. David, you were talking about military combat fatigue, but you also write about interns and interns working, you know, 18, 24 hours in one particular kind of shift, but some interesting research on that.
Exactly. So many, becoming a doctor is very tough, obviously. And part of the training is that you stay awake maybe 24 hours, 36 hours straight in a hospital. And so researchers thought, let's see what the outcome of that is. When the doctors were at the hospital, they weren't making that many mistakes. You know, they were good at their jobs. They were learning their jobs, but they're still good at them. Once they got in their cars and drove home, however, they were in higher rates. There's basically an easy correlation. The longer you spent at the hospital, the longer you had sleep deprivation, the more likely it was that you're going to get an accident.
Wow.
And part of the reason is that such an intense job, you're so focused, then you have that focus kind of, you give yourself a little bit of breathing room. That breathing room easily turns into sleeping room. So you might fall asleep behind the wheel. You might fall asleep at a red light. And it's almost as if you're pushing your body so hard, your body eventually is going to win.
And our naps, there was a time when people, especially those who were struggling with sleep, were told, don't take a nap, you know, save up so that you can sleep at night. What's the research on naps today?
Naps are one of the best things you can do, not only for your body, obviously, but for your brain as well. Research has shown that those who take naps are able to solve puzzles faster. They learn information better. They make better decisions afterwards. And, you know, this nap can last from as few as 20 minutes to an hour, 2 hours. NASA has found, they did research with astronauts taking naps. And if they took a short nap, maybe 20 minutes, the effects were great in terms of they started paying more attention to all those kind of boring things that were so vital. You know, checking your oxygen level, checking off all the just going down the checklist of everything you need to do. The idea that, you know, maybe it kind of goes into the circadian rhythm in terms of when you should take a nap. Like trying to take a nap from 6 to 7:30 might be tough because then it's harder to go back to sleep immediately. But if you take a nap at 2, you know, 2 to 3, you get back up, you're going to probably go back to sleep at the same time. What we have what are called sleep gates. So these are times it's easy to naturally fall asleep. Most of us have one, but around 2 to 4, you know, after lunch.
Siesta time, right?
Exactly. You know, some people might think, oh, I just had a big lunch, that's why I'm tired. No, it's also your circadian rhythm. It's naturally, that's a time when it's easy to fall asleep. 10 o'clock is a time that's naturally easy to fall asleep.
Let me get to that. Looks like John from Maryland to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I served in the submarine service in the 80s during the Cold War, and we used to go out on the ballistic missile submarines for months at a time, and we had an 18-hour day. And once we were underwater just punching holes, we would go for a couple months, 6 hours on, 6 hours off, and 6 hours of sleep. Everyone seemed to adjust very quickly, and there was almost no fatigue when you're operating in the engine room and whatnot. And then towards the end of the patrol, when we would do drills where you'd have to stay up for 24 or 48 hours, had a saying in the Navy that 5 minutes was worth laying down and 10 minutes was worth getting undressed. and there were very few incidents that involved people being tired when you were running drills and had emergencies.
That's fascinating.
Under both situations.
Well, yeah, that's very, very interesting. Now, go ahead, David. Your thoughts.
That is fascinating. So much of that, you know, you have such a different exposure to light when you're in a submarine, obviously. But, you know, there's also research that has looked at what are the effects of sleep deprivation in wartime. One of the most famous incidents of this, it was in World War II. It was the Battle for Guadalcanal. And this was a time when, you know, the Americans, we had just had an attack on a Japanese position, and they were expecting a counterattack. And they were expecting this counterattack to come from the air. So everyone was kind of focused on the air. It was the highest readiness level. The attack really came from other ships. So when the ships passed some of the American ships, the captains didn't realize, they couldn't conceive of the fact that they were getting attacked by other boats, essentially. It was as if they'd gone so long with sleep deprivation, their mind had been fixed on one thing. It couldn't be anything else. They lost that ability of flexible thinking, which is an important part of dealing with any situation. And, you know, a couple American ships were sunk. And, you know, hundreds or the thousands of people lost their lives. And, you know, there's an inquiry into it. And, you know, researchers now look at this, you know, military researchers from Walter Reed and all these other places look at sleep deprivation as a huge impact on wartime.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Debbie from Audubon has to say. And Debbie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I have three young children, all with horrible sleep problems.
Oh,
and so we've basically spent the last 9 years making our everyday sleep friendly, so to say. And as a mom thinking about helping them to be successful for the rest of their future, I'm wondering if he came across any relationship between how you sleep as a child to how you'll sleep as an adult, or how you handle that as you get older if you do have sleep problems.
Well, you're talking to someone who used to fall asleep with his eyes open when he was a little kid, Debbie. Let me see what David says.
That's a great question. You know, there's so many different answers to it, too. If somebody has a sleep condition like I do, it might stay with you forever, and you just kind of have to change certain things on how you deal with that. But the idea of focusing on getting as much sleep for your children as possible, that's the best thing you can do, because those are you're gonna have the best outcomes that way. There have been recent research that has found that perhaps you know, incidents of bullying, that could be an aspect of sleep deprivation on the part of bullies. You know, that so much of childhood is learning to be calm and in control of your emotions, and then if you're not getting sleep, then you're gonna act out. You're not gonna want to pay attention in class. You're gonna be angrier. You're gonna have more conflicts with other people. Getting as much sleep can not only help you in terms of your health outcomes, but it can help you in terms of your academic outcomes as well.
And I think things like this, it's part of parenting, which is that you want your children to do something, but you can't be anxious about it, right?
Exactly. It's not giving somebody else that anxiety that turns into insomnia. And realizing that sleep isn't necessarily something, it's not that on-off switch. There's going to be times when somebody wakes up. There's going to be times when, you know, there might be, you know, it might be hard to fall asleep some nights. But hopefully you'll have a chance to make that up at another time.
Debbie, good luck to you. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Jen from South Philadelphia has to say. Jen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if you've come across anything in your studies between depression and sleep, because that's something that I've been having trouble with since I was diagnosed with depression. It seems to be manifesting itself the most in having sleep issues. So I was just wondering if you had come across anything like that.
Jen, that's a tough situation. Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, that is tough, and that's something that pops up a lot. And for sleep researchers, this is a hard issue to deal with, because sometimes it can be a chicken or the egg situation. You know, is it the depression leading to sleeplessness, or is it the sleeplessness leading to depression? You know, and this is even starting to change how people look at postpartum depression, that perhaps it's, you know, it's obviously the hormones, but it's also when you have a new child, you are not getting any sleep whatsoever, especially for women, if they're breastfeeding and all those other things that go into it, that can lead to postpartum, that can lead to depression itself. Generally, what researchers say, how to kind of treat this is to to try to get as much, you know, it sounds hard, but to get as much sleep as possible. And the way to do that is to have some kind of rhythm so your body knows what it should be doing. There's this idea, too, that exercise helps you sleep. And in the book, I talk about research that kind of shows this is a two-sided coin. There's research that looked at, okay, let's just physically exhaust people and see if it's just that makes you fall asleep. And it wasn't that. Somebody could have run farther than others. It was how taxing you felt that to be. If you
your own perception of your exhaustion.
Exactly. Huh. So if you thought you were working really hard, it would be easier for you to fall asleep. If you thought that it wasn't as taxing on you or that you should have gone faster or done more, it was harder for you to fall asleep. So it's the mental aspect of sleep is always with us. It's not just a physical condition.
And Jen, hopefully, again, I said this to another caller, that you're getting some help from your physician on this issue. But I also wonder, David, about just medications for things like depression and how that could possibly affect sleep.
There's so many different terms, so many different ways of treating it. So it's hard to make a easy 1-to-2 comparison. One thing that people tend to turn to, though, is sleeping pills. And research has shown that sleeping pills themselves might not be as the cure-all as you expect. The way that Ambien and some of these other drugs work is that they essentially give you short-term amnesia, so that maybe you take it at 10 o'clock at night, you fall asleep, you wake up 6 hours later, and you don't remember anything, so you think you were fine. But it turns out that you might have been tossing and turning, you might have been walking around, and you just don't remember. Research has shown that these pills maybe make you fall asleep 10 minutes, 12 minutes faster, stay awake 10 minutes, 12 minutes longer, but that's about it.
Let me see what Beth from Bethlehem has to say. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Question is probably pretty relevant. Having a two-month-old baby, you probably have run into this, and maybe in research you have, nightlights. Mm-hmm. I have two children. One child absolutely does not want one and falls asleep in the dark, which I hear is the best way to fall asleep. The other child has to have a nightlight, but from what I read, light disturbs your sleep. So if I sneak in and turn the light off, and then he wakes up and the light's off, he freaks out and then doesn't sleep. So have you heard anything in the research about what the recommendation is for that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Beth, just a quick question. For the child that likes to sleep with the light on, does he or she go to sleep with the light on?
Yeah, goes to sleep fine as long as the light's on. But if, perchance, I turn it off in hopes of giving him some more quality sleep and he wakes up and it's off, then it's over.
Okay, I hear you. Go ahead, Dave.
So much of when kids go to sleep, it's them maintaining a rhythm and a routine. You know, there's research that basically found that maybe, you know, if you put your baby down when he's already asleep, when he wakes him or herself up, it'll be harder for him to fall back asleep because he's just not used to doing it. So it might be 3 or 4 nights where you have the light off and he or she does not like it. But, you know, you're malleable. You can adapt. So it might take a little time. It might force yourself to hear those cries. That's one of the hardest things to do. But in terms of just the actual, the light part of it, most night lights, they're maybe about as bright as a candle. They're not going to be bright enough to really change your sleep rhythms. Your brain isn't going to think that's sunlight. It's really, you know, light bulbs that are 40 watts, 60 watts and above. That's when it gets started to get an issue of tricking your brain.
And what about having the radio on while you sleep? Has there been research on that?
Some people like it. It's, you know, it's everything what calms you down. I have a friend who's a firefighter, and he cannot fall asleep without the TV on. And, you know, perhaps it's a comforting thing for him. You know, just it's almost like his nightlight, even though if I said that was his nightlight, he would hate me.
But he's all the way up in Brooklyn somewhere. He's
exactly.
Maybe not listening to this show. Let me squeeze on. Looks like, sorry about this, Virginia. Christine from Virginia. And Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I had a question for the journalist about sleep talking. I've been talking ever since I was a child, and I read that you're supposed to outgrow it into adolescence. And I still haven't outgrown it, and I tend to say, like, embarrassing things in my sleep, too. So I've had problems with roommates and stuff in college. And I was just wondering, like, how you, like, if you could do anything sure. about sleep talking and like if you could outgrow it?
It's a good question, Christine. Thanks
that
for
is
the call.
That is a great question. I haven't outgrown my sleep talking either. So, you know, I'm right there with you. Researchers don't exactly know why we sleep talk or why we sleep walk or all these other things. Generally, they think, you know, the brain, when you fall asleep, it essentially paralyzes itself so you don't act out your dreams. But this doesn't always work exactly perfectly. So that can lead to the sleep talking. Or people who don't sleep as deeply tend to sleep talk or sleep walk more often. It's almost as if your brain is literally half asleep. You know, in the book, I talk about this famous case where somebody was sleepwalking, and while he was sleepwalking, he drove 14 miles to his in-law's house, let himself in with his key, and he ended up stabbing his mother-in-law to death and almost killed his father-in-law. And, you know, in the trial a year later, he was acquitted because his doctors and his lawyers were able to convince the jury that it was just an extreme case of sleepwalking. In terms of how you deal with sleep talking, you know, the more pedestrian things, there's all different ways, but generally the best is to, you know, have a conversation with the person who might be sharing the bed with you. And, you know, obviously talk to your doctor, but there isn't much in terms of prescription drugs or anything else that you can really do for it.
We're almost out of time here, but having done this book, do you get a better night's sleep that you know more about it?
I do. I mean, with a baby, it's always hard, but I do sleep much better because I'm kind of realizing that sleep takes work, and I see all the benefits of it. I see that sleep is the way to become the most competent version of myself.
Well, David K. Randall, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Dreamland. Well, we want to close things out in this hour of Radio Times. Madeline Peru sings the title song of her 1996 debut album. It is called Dreamland. Let's listen.
In your arms, in your warmth, in your love. Sleeping away the day, hoping that we two could stay all alone, on our own revelry. Let's make a pact for our lives in a home. Built on the bricks that we made. Two of us together.